We begin with our first case, United Food Services v. Drivers Helpers Local Union, number 355. Mr. Starr, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Sorry, Your Honor, the last time I was here I was in a different courtroom. I think you might have changed the arrangement since then. It's about 14 years ago. Good morning, Your Honors. Paul Starr on behalf of the Appellant Truck Drivers and Helpers Local 355 Health and Welfare Fund. May it please the Court. Your Honor, there are three broad reasons I will explain to you this morning why the District Court erred in its ruling. It ruled in favor of U.S. Food Service on its motion for summary judgment and denied the funds, as I will refer to the health fund, cross motion for summary judgment. One is the CBA, the contract language, and the trust agreement language. When there is tension between the two with respect to the contributions owed to the funds, our position is that the trust agreement language governs. The second is that with respect to the collective bargaining agreement language itself, appropriate review that the district court refused to engage in involves course of dealings to discern the true party's intent. Third, if the court correctly determined, the court below correctly determined that interpretation of the CBA did not require going beyond the four corners of the page, that is, it employed the plain meaning rule, then U.S. Foods cannot prevail in any event because it failed to allege, much less prove, the statutory and equitable requisites entitling it to recovery of return of contributions.
You're talking about the course of dealing and everything, but doesn't this hinge all on in the first place on Section 403C2A and whether there's been a determination of a plan administrator that there was a mistake of law or fact?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. I think that's the starting point.
It's got to be the starting point, doesn't it?
I believe it is, and I don't think that the company in this case got out of the starting gate in that regard.
If we were going to take extrinsic evidence and everything, that wouldn't be a job for the district court. I mean, that would normally be the job here for the plan administrator in making a determination, wouldn't it?
Well, I think so, Your Honor, with one exception. If the plan administrator, as happened in this case, did not determine that there was a mistake in payment of contributions, I suppose that could be reviewed for abuse of discretion.
It could be, but even if you review for abuse of discretion, it wouldn't necessarily require taking extrinsic evidence if the plan administrator made a reasonable determination.
Oh, I agree with you there. We were starting from a point of the district court saying, I'm not going to look at why the plan administrator did not determine there was a mistake. I'm looking strictly at the CBA language.
So your view is that January the 5th letter from Corey Smith Bott to Mr. Salomon was a determination by the plan administrator that there was no mistake of law or fact?
That was a reiteration of a prior determination by the actual plan administrator who said essentially the same thing 4 months earlier in September, I believe.
What page of the JA is that on?
Your Honor, I neglected to bring my joint appendix with me. It is it was a determination made in September, I believe, of 2008 in response to a query from the company on these overtime paid contributions.
So the January 5th, 2009 letter was simply a reiteration.
Correct.
Of the earlier plan determination.
Correct.
That no mistake of law or fact was made.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And the district court was essentially reviewing that. It certainly wouldn't be completely de novo because these kind of determinations are generally made in the first instance and are accorded some respect by the plan administrator that deals with the plan on a day-to-day basis. Wouldn't you agree?
I agree, Your Honor. Interestingly, the district court did not even address the issue of the plan administrator's determination. The district court focused solely, and this admittedly, the summary judgment happened in two different segments, Your Honor. There was a finding, a ruling on the contract interpretation language. Then the court had to do an initial evaluation of what the appropriate remedy was. And at that point, the fund emphasized the 403 issue, and the court, in its supplemental memorandum opinion, said, I'm not going to address that. I already did address it. But indeed, if you look at the court's June 21, 2010 memorandum opinion,
your position is that under the statutory provision, 403C2A, all the plan administrator needed to do was to make a reasonable interpretation of a plan.
Correct. And that, when you, in terms of looking at extrinsic evidence, I suppose if that was being reviewed for abuse of discretion or unreasonableness.
But what your view is that with even without the extrinsic evidence, there's a certain ambiguity here, but this plan had been interpreted in one way over a period of decades.
It was over half a century, Your Honor.
And it wasn't an unreasonable ruling to say that what it meant was that up to 50 hours, the company was required to pay straight time rather than overtime.
Well, the position of the fund, based on 50 years of consistent history and contribution payments from this same employer, was that there may have been inartful drafting in the CBA, but that inartful drafting had continued over 20 successive collective bargaining agreements unchanged, and the consistent course of dealing was also unchanged for that period of time from 1957 until early 2008, whereby the company paid on all paid hours up to 50 in a week, regardless of the underlying wage rate.
It could be read two ways. Number one was the way the district court read it, which was that you only pay for straight time, which would be 40 hours a week. That's one reading. Another reading is that, look, they've interpreted this over a period of decades to indicate that even though those hours from 40 to 50 are generally considered overtime, the CBA's phraseology of straight time would indicate that straight time pay could be made for those 10 hours. But you got two reasonable interpretations.
Well, that's our position. And at bottom, Your Honor, this was a situation, you have to look back at the genesis of this language. This was back in the mid-50s when the bargaining parties were a much smaller employer at the time. And essentially, truck drivers, these were not drafted by lawyers or professionals. And that language started one interpretation and continued uninterrupted for literally over 50 years until, according to the company, a comptroller took a look at the language and said, wait, we only have to pay on straight time hours.
Is your first argument that the district judge in this case simply misapplied the standard of review and we ought to send it back for that, or are you suggesting that we can decide on our own whether or not this was a reasonable interpretation, this longstanding interpretation?
I'm suggesting, Your Honor, you can decide on your own. I think you start with 403. That is the statute that says in very, for lack of a better term, severe terms, this is the anti-inurement rule, that says the assets of a plan, like the health fund, shall never inure to the benefit of any employer and shall be held for the exclusive purposes of providing benefits to participants in the plan and their beneficiaries and defraying reasonable expenses of administering the plan. That's the rule. That's in stark terms. The narrowly crafted exceptions to the rule, one of which could apply here, is where, if a contribution is made by mistake of law or fact, ERISA does not prohibit, it does not mandate, but it does not prohibit the return of contributions so long as there's the repayment is made within a time-limited period. Again, this is to preserve the assets of the fund. And an additional hurdle, after and only after the plan administrator determines that the contribution was made by such a mistake. So you've got a number of hurdles that were not even attempted crossed by the company in this case. Nowhere in the complaint.
Or considered by the district court. So why not simply send it back and let him figure it out?
I think as a matter of law, he can decide that the company hasn't met its proofs in this case. Or frankly, even its 12B6 obligation. I think that's the reason that this court need not remand it.
Your view that if the plan administrator has made a determination, and that determination is an arguable or reasonable one, not an abuse of discretion, that's it.
Precisely, Your Honor, and it's a very deferential standard because of the overarching policies of ERISA are to preserve assets of these trust funds. These are trust funds. These are not corporations. There's no windfall here in taking in assets that a fund is not entitled to. All of the assets must go to pay benefits, pension, health and welfare, sickness benefits to participants and beneficiaries. So that's why there's such a deferential standard. That's why you have the anti-inurement rule in such stark terms, and that's why the crafted exceptions are so narrow in scope.
Now you mentioned this long-standing interpretation of 50 plus years, but you know, I looked at this record. Besides the the statements of the plan about this long-standing interpretation, what is there in the record? I mean, that's an assertion, but I didn't see it supported by the record.
It's supported, Your Honor, by affidavit testimony that was contradicted in any way by U.S. Foods. We had two affidavits from trustees of the plan, as well as one who served as a union representative, who said this is the way it has always been done. Now, one of our arguments, we didn't emphasize this on appeal, but one of our arguments indeed was a latches argument. If you're going to pay one way for 51 years and then say we paid incorrectly and sue for the period for return of contributions for the period which the applicable statute of limitations would allow, then you've prejudiced the fund here because it can't go back and say and knock on the graves because of the parties who negotiated that original language, which stayed again uniform throughout 20 successive collective bargaining agreements, are no longer around. The court rejected our argument on latches because it said, well, I'm not going beyond the four corners of the agreement, so therefore, if I don't have to look at extrinsic evidence, that makes the latches argument irrelevant in terms of prejudice.
Now the appellees in this case make an argument that it would be a little bit redundant for straight time as an adjective to mean simply all hours, that it's got to mean something else, that there's got to be a distinction. But why is that not a reasonable and, in fact, the only interpretation of this agreement?
Well, because, again, going back to this is old language. This was negotiated by boots on the ground working people. And as we explained through affidavit, there is an explanation for it. There was a good intent for it. It was in artful drafting, but the intent, as explained by affidavit from one of the trustees, is this, that because there are overtime provisions, and using the broadest overtime provisions in the CBAs, you get time and a half after 40. But also because under the CBA, the employer is obligated to make contributions on hours up to 50, the reason the straight time modifier was originally placed in there was to attempt, perhaps not well, but attempt to make clear that the employer did not owe an overtime or a premium contribution rate on those overtime wage hours. So in other words, if the contribution rate was $1 an hour, but you got time and a half after 40, that the contribution rate would stay static for hours 41 through 50 at 1 hour. It would not jump up, similar to the wage rate, from $1 to $1.50 for the contribution for those hours. That was the explanation. I realize that we don't have the original drafters of that language, but that is the explanation that's been passed down through the union leadership for the decades as to why that language originally was in there as it is. It is in artful drafting. We concede that.
All right. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
You've got some rebuttal time. Mr. Mikulowicz.
Thank you. May it please the court. Stefan Markowitz from Littler Mendelsohn in Washington, D.C. on behalf of the Appalee U.S. Foods. This case is effectively about the attempt by an employer to try to recoup some of the money that it lost when it made mistaken overpayments into the multi-employer health and welfare and pension fund. The appeal here today is only dealing with the health and welfare fund, but for all intents and purposes, we were dealing with a mistake that was made involving contribution obligations that were, that mistake was made by the same person over the course of the same period of time. And we have somewhat of an inconsistency here because the health fund is claiming that they don't owe restitution to the company in response to the overtime overpayments.
But you unilaterally said, well, we made a mistake, but the statute says that the plan administrator has to make that determination as whether a mistake of law or fact was made. It doesn't give you the right to make a unilateral determination, nor, frankly, does it give the district court the authority to just go at this de novo and not take it, cognizance of what the plan administrator has done here. There's a danger where there's a Scrivener's error or where you've added an extra zero or something like that. You want companies to be able to recoup funds because otherwise they won't make any payments into the fund if they could never recoup. But on the other hand, it would play absolute havoc actuarially to have funds put into these trust funds and then withdrawn every time the company comes up with a new interpretation of a plan. That's just going to play havoc with ERISA funds and with the provision in the statute that these funds are held for the exclusive purposes of providing benefits to participants of the plan. And that's the starting point here. And it seems to me you're asserting something close, not completely, but something close to a unilateral right to withdraw funds when, in your view, an interpretation of the plan that you agreed to for many years is suddenly wrong. And what does that do to the administration of these plans? What does that do to the benefits on which these employees are counting? And what does it do to the statute, which said that the plan administrator is the one that makes this determination? The plan administrator, both initially and through Mr. Bott's letter, indicated that no, there wasn't. It says, emphatically, there wasn't a mistake of law or fact here. And that may not, that might be an ironclad interpretation of the plan, but I'm not sure whether it was an abuse of discretion for the administrator to say that, and I'm not sure whether it was an unreasonable interpretation of the plan. And they've been doing it. What's wrong with saying this means you pay at a regular rate for up to 50 hours, and not at the overtime rate I mean, it was one time thought that this was a very beneficial deal for the company to play at a regular rate up to 50 hours and not in an overtime.
No, Your Honor, I fundamentally disagree with that analysis. This is not undermining the financial, you know, the actuarial assumptions of the plan. This is a collective bargaining agreement that defines how the company contributes into the plan. It is an agreement reached between the union and the company. The plan is a third-party beneficiary of that collective bargaining agreement. That collective bargaining agreement contains very clear and unambiguous language with respect to exactly what the contribution requirements are. It says up to 50 straight time hours. It makes it very clear that it's straight time hours. This company contributes a substantial amount of money into this fund for the straight time hours, up to 40 hours for each week and for each hour worked by each employee.
That may be your view of it, but the point is the plan administrator has made those are the trustees of the plan. They're the ones that are dealing with this plan day in and day out. They're the ones that have the history of the plan in mind. They're the ones whom the statute entrusts with the responsibility to make a determination, and they've made a determination directly contrary to what you said.
And their determination was wrong. As Judge Mott said, it was untenable. There is no way the interpretation that the fund, that the administrator that Ms. Bott gave, which is in the January letter, because that was the only correspondence that the company received from the fund. The prior correspondence that the company received from the fund was a request for more information in response to the company's request that the money be returned. The plan document also specifies in two locations that the money, the funds of the plan do not revert back to the employer except in the case of a mistake. If a company is
I'm not sure their view is all that wrong. The letter says the plain language of the CBA requires employee benefit contributions on up to 50 hours per week. The modifier straight time indicates that contributions are owed at the applicable contribution rate regardless of the rate of pay earned by the company's employee for the particular hour. Now, you know, you disagree with that, and I understand that, but we owe a measure of respect to what this plan administrator has said, and it's not a crazy interpretation of the plan. In fact, it's an ambiguously drafted CBA where you can read it the way the district court read it, but you can also read it the way the plan administrator read it. And the point is, standards of review do matter, and the statute, entrustment of responsibility for the plan administrator, the Congress did not want companies essentially later in the day withdrawing funds from these plans. The whole premise of these is that the benefits in this trust fund will inure to the benefit of the beneficiaries.
And we don't disagree with that, but if there's a mistake that was made in the contribution calculations, that is something that the money should come back to the employer.
Well, not necessarily. There are two issues here. One is the standard of review question, which Judge Wilkinson has pointed out, that the district court simply applied its own view of the plan language. He may be right. But as Judge Wilkinson points out, there may be an equally reasonable interpretation. Why not send the case back for the judge to apply the proper standard, number one? And second, even if there was a mistake made with respect to the interpretation of the plan, equity doesn't necessarily command a return of the monies. It's a determination as to whether or not it's appropriate under the facts and circumstances of this case for that return to be made if, in fact, a mistake was made. And the district judge never got to that portion of the analysis. So why shouldn't go back as to those two separate issues?
Well, with respect to the latter issue, Your Honor, the return of the contributions, the claim that was brought, and we brought two separate claims. We brought a claim under 403, under ERISA specifically. We also brought an unjust enrichment claim. And that unjust enrichment claim is clearly an equitable claim under all sense of the under the Waller analysis and under the analyses of the Fourth Circuit on these particular issues, okay? And Judge Motz decided this case based on the information that was presented to him by the parties. Consistent with that, the fund actually conceded that certain contributions were mistakenly, you know, notwithstanding what they said in their January letter, in the subsequent litigation of the case, they conceded that certain contributions on hours for workers' comp and on hours for short-term disability were in fact returnable. The fund even represented to Judge Motz that it would try to reach a determination onto the amount that was due. And Your Honor, in the first appeal of this case, the fund actually represented to this court that all that it was left to do was to determine the amount due, and that, you know, all of those Judge Motz considered all of those factors. He did in the subsequent summary judgment order that he issued, but the bottom line is that he considered everything that was presented to him.
Yeah, but why isn't the January 5th letter and the September 2008 letter, why aren't they in combination a plain determination on the part of the, I mean, the letter doesn't leave much room for interpretation.
And the letter interprets the collective bargaining agreement wrongly, Your Honor. I mean, it's there's only one interpretation of straight
you're
time.
You're acting like you're a plan administrator.
I'm just reading a collective bargaining agreement in its plain meaning, Your Honor. I mean, straight time under the definition set forth in the definition set forth in the actual contract itself, the term straight time is not used any other way. And in fact, the origin of this may very well have had to do with the fact that employees were eligible to work more than 50, be paid for more than 50 straight time hours. I mean, the language is pretty precise in that regard, and I disagree with the fact this was just an agreement reached by, you know, a couple of truck drivers. I disagree with that. I think this was very specific with respect to straight time hours. The other issue is overtime is a variable factor. Overtime is a variable factor. At least under these terms of this collective bargaining agreement, the employees get a guaranteed 40 hours, and then they get an additional potential up to 10 straight time hours for vacation, bank days. There are various configurations of the collective bargaining agreement that authorize payment for more than 40 straight time hours.
If it was as clear as you say it is, and given this long history of making these payments 50 plus years by the other side's account, isn't that a factor that cuts against your claim that there's only one reasonable interpretation here? I mean, the fact that this was mistake was being made, you know,
Your Honor, we made a mistake. We recognize that. I think in the record that was considered by Judge Motz, as well as what's in the joint appendix, there is evidence from.
I guess my point is, if the mistake is as obvious as you make it out to be, how come it took so long to get fixed?
We made a mistake. A mistake is a mistake. If we had made the mistake the other way around, and we had under-contributed into the plan, this would be, the fund would be coming after us for this money. You look at some of the cases that we cited in the brief, it's very clear that a mistake made for a long period of time doesn't make it any less of a mistake. And if there's an obligation to contribute into the plan pursuant to that, even if the mistake had been made, there's one case, I think it was 25 years, where a certain interpretation of the collective bargaining agreement was used by the employer. And that interpretation was said, that's inconsistent with the unambiguous language of the collective bargaining agreement, and therefore you're bound, as an employer, you're bound to the language of the contract. And
you can repeat as often as you want that a mistake was made, but I'm not so sure a mistake was made. I mean, it strikes me as a reasonably close question, and it strikes me that the union's position here is not off the wall. What the union says is, look, you got a good deal out of this, and when you take this provision as a whole, it means you pay at the regular rate for up to 50 hours. And that the modifier, straight time, what that does is indicate the contributions are owed at the applicable contribution rate. That they're owed for the straight time rate. Now, that, you know, as Judge Diaz points out, that interpretation draws from the language of the CBA, and it's followed for so many years. And with that much money on the line, if this was so wrong, somebody might have discovered it. But all of a sudden, late in the day, you know, you come up with a different view.
It's not, we came up with a different view. It is, we assigned it to a payroll clerk. We didn't train her properly. You know, mistakes get made. Certain people get delegated certain responsibilities, and those mistakes are made. And when we come in and look at it, a new person comes in with a fresh set of eyes and looks at the case, looks at the language and says, wait a minute, we're not supposed to contribute this way. It says straight time. In order to give the fund the language that the, in order to give the fund what the fund wants in terms of the interpretation of this collective bargaining agreement, as Judge Mott said, you have to write straight time out of the contract. You have to ignore it because there is no variation in the amount of the contribution. I still struggle to this day completely getting my arms around what this interpretation is by the fund because you know, Judge Mott concluded that it was untenable. There was no way this language could be interpreted that way. So I understand that it's a mistake. Look, I'm not here to make excuses for the mistake. The reality of it is a mistake was made. We are entitled, we should be able to say, wait a minute, we made a mistake, and we should be able to stop having to continue to make the mistake, number one, and then assuming that we made a mistake and it cost us some money, see that money back. And consistent with everything that had happened in this case and representations by the fund to this court and to the lower court, they were going to calculate the amount due. And the other thing is, Your Honor, we do have this situation where there's an...
You're not factoring the standard of review into your argument. You just aren't.
How are we not factoring the standard review into the argument? The fund made an interpretation of the collective bargaining agreement. They refused to interpreted the contract in their January letter. That interpretation was untenable as decided by Judge Motz.
Applying de novo review.
Applying any review.
Well, he didn't apply any review. He applied de novo review.
And he looked at
looking at it independently for the first time, stepping into the shoes of the health plan administrator, which Judge Wilkinson indicates the judge should not do, that might be appropriate. But again, standards of review do matter.
And under the circumstances, what we have here is an unjust enrichment claim. The fact of the matter is that in this case, we made a mistake. They have money that they shouldn't have received, and we should be able to get that back.
I don't understand why this case could very easily be decided on the papers, and I don't understand why we wouldn't be in as good a position as Judge Motz to decide whether there was an abuse of discretion here in the terms of the plan determination. I'm afraid this thing, if it went back, he just sort of plant the flag on his original determination and say, well, it doesn't matter what the course of dealing is, this is it, I've said it. He's already said that there's only one way you can possibly look at it. So he's already made the determination, essentially, in his own opinion, that there was an abuse of discretion. Now, you know, that makes me wonder what would be gained by sending it back, because he's essentially said there's only one way you can possibly look at this. And, you know, but not only does that, you know, it indicates precisely what would happen on remand, I think, if we sent it back.
But if you were to give Judge Motz the opportunity, if you were going to apply the standard of review as was referenced by Judge Diaz, he should have the opportunity. If you are going to make if this is going to apply, Judge Motz should make that determination.
He's already said there's only one way you can look at this, and that's my way. That's the only way you can look at this. So if we send it back, we're going to get another appeal. It's perfectly clear that, yes, he's going to say the trustee made an abuse of discretion.
And this court could make the same determination, I suppose. But Judge Motz should be given the opportunity to do that if the standard of review is going to be applied in conjunction with the January letter.
He's done it.
So are you agreeing that the standard of review was not applied?
I am saying that the standard of review is in the context of the unjust enrichment claim that was brought by that U.S. Foods brought to, you know, in connection with this case. I would say that the judge looked at that, concluded that it effectuated the intent of the parties it furthers the intent of the parties in the contract under Waller, and reached the conclusion that the language was the language warranted return of the restitution and return of the money to U.S. Foods. I don't say he necessarily had to apply that standard of review, but if this...
He can just leapfrog over it if he's convinced that there is no ambiguity. He can ignore the statutory framework.
Well, on this issue, Your Honor, there's a statutory framework, but there's also the common law unjust enrichment claim. And I would submit that in that common law unjust enrichment claim, this standard of review has not been addressed by this court. And Judge Motz worked with the courts, with the opinions and decisions of this court on the standard of review. He cited Waller, he cited Cohen, the two key cases on the issue. And that's how he reached his decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Picking up on counsel's last point, this case is not about the Waller case. We recognize that in Waller, this court said where an employer cannot get into court through a direct ERISA action, which it cannot, because there's no 1132 jurisdiction for an employer. Waller said you can bring under the federal common law an unjust enrichment claim. However, that does not void the statute. That does not void the mandate of Section 403. It does not void the anti-inurement rule. It does not void the exceptions to that rule, which Judge Motz, I say respectively, completely ignored. He did not apply the rule. He did not make a finding that the determination was by the plan administrator was unreasonable or an abuse of discretion. It didn't happen here. And beyond...
So should he be given another chance to do that?
Your Honor, I don't think so because, as I said, the company brought this claim. The company had to prove its claim. The company had to prove there was a determination of mistake made by the plan administrator or, in the absence of it making a determination, that failure was an abuse of discretion. And the inquiry doesn't end there. The company also failed to allege or prove, beyond the mandates of the exception to the anti-inurement rule, that the equities, as Judge Diaz pointed out, must favor return of the contribution.
And that was the company's burden?
That was the company's burden. They put on no evidence of that. Through multiple depositions, through two rounds of summary judgment, Judge Wilkerson...
They didn't need to. I mean, they didn't need to the way the judge handled the case, right?
Perhaps they thought they didn't, but that doesn't make what the judge did following the law.
No, I agree, but I don't know that necessarily supports your argument because the judge was rolling with their position all along, so there was no need to argue the equities.
Well, I think under the state of the law, they needed to make the proof. Whether they had the judge rolling with them on one line of argument or not, they still have to meet the requirements of the law.
What about the employer's argument that, picking up on Judge Keenan's point, that you all essentially had conceded the claim and simply were haggling as to how much, if any, to return in terms of contributions? Doesn't that suggest that there really was no issue as to the equities in this case?
No, Your Honor, respectfully, that's not correct. What we conceded was that, see, there were three different categories of alleged overpayments. One respected these overtime hours, which is the crux of this appeal. The second was a category of paid hours for employees who are out on short-term disability. We conceded that the collective bargaining agreement, the governing trust agreement of the fund, did not require contributions on these hours. And we will return those. Because the plan administrator determined there was a mistake in that case. The third category of hours, contributions for employees who were out on workers' compensation for more than 52 weeks, those payments we also, the plan administrator determined, were made by mistake. So that's what was referenced, I believe. We are fighting about the overtime hours, and that's the bulk of the contributions here today. And if I may return to a point a minute ago, you know, the reason that the fund requested oral argument is because while there's more law on point on the equities finding that is required in other circuits, this court did state back in 1981 under the Cassidy trucking case that under 403C2A, when the plan administrator determines there was a mistake of law or fact with respect to employer contributions, that does not give an automatic right to return of those contributions.
So it's still permissive, even at that point.
Indeed. Indeed.
Does plenary discretion arise in the trustees at that point on the second phase of it as to whether there's a return of funds, or is that subject to an abuse of discretion standard as well?
I think the standard there is whether there's a breach of fiduciary duty, because the trustees of the fund have a fiduciary obligation to preserve the assets of the fund, to use the assets solely for the purpose of providing benefits to participants and beneficiaries, and defraying reasonable expenses of operating the fund. Now, if the fund, in your scenario, Judge Wilkerson, if the fund administrator said, yes, there was a mistake, no, we're not going to return the mistakenly paid contributions because we don't feel like it, that might give rise to a claim by a participant for a breach of fiduciary duty, or a claim by the employer for abuse of discretion. But here, you know, that is an analysis. You have to give discretion because to the administrator, when he finds a mistake, to return or not return. You have to look at things like the financial stability of the fund and whether it would harm the ability for the fund to pay.
We don't even get to any of this if the fund's interpretation of the collective bargaining agreement was a reasonable one or was within its discretion. We don't even get to that.
I wholeheartedly agree.
It doesn't have to be the correct one.
That's correct.
It's simply if it was in the realm of reason.
And that is in line with the overarching policies of ERISA, that money goes into the fund, a trust fund, for the benefit of the participants' beneficiaries. It's almost a one-way ratchet. It should not easily return.
Well, it's not a one-way ratchet because you don't want it so strict that companies can never get back something that they mistakenly paid in, or where the trustee's determination is so far beyond the pale of reason that it just doesn't hold up. But the plan administrator here has written a detailed letter explaining its position, explaining its interpretation of the plan, explaining why they believe it flows from the practice of the parties and why they believe it flows from the language of the plan. And the question is, really purely and simply, given ERISA's purposes and given the discretion that this statute resides in trustees, was that beyond the pale?
I agree, and I see my time is up. Thank you.